Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today's guest is registered dietitian and licensed nutritionist, Tavis Piattoli. He is a counselor and advisor and dietitian to a variety of sports teams, and he also has a very interesting website with lots of links and blogs and features at mysportsdconnect.com or mysportsd.com, correct?
Yes, sir, that's it.
Okay, good. And he also is host of his own podcast, which I think you can also access through mysportsd.com. Boy, it's really reassuring. You know, whenever I book a guest, you know, some people, they're very knowledgeable, but it's always reassuring that someone has their own podcast. You know, because you know that the talking is their strong suit. So you've capably fulfilled that that mission in part one of our podcast on sports nutrition. If you haven't listened to it, folks, please go back to part one. In this part of the podcast, we're going to focus though on specific supplements. Do they work? Are they overhyped? But before we do that, you know, let's talk a little bit about vegetarian nutrition for athletes. There are some athletes who really tout the benefits of a vegetarian diet. A prominent one was basketball player Bill Walton. He used to play for Portland, the Trailblazers. And is that a good way to go for high-end athletes? Is it doable, or do you have to have special, or there's special things you have to do to make sure that you're getting adequate nutrition?
Yeah, it's very doable, and there's pros and cons. I mean, I've seen good case studies or good clients of mine of athletes that have done really well, and I've seen some that have tried it and didn't do as well because they're just so used to their, you know, eating habits. The biggest challenge, and I actually had a college swimmer the other day, looked at her food log for about 5 days, and she, you know, she's more pescatarian, but really trying to focus is, you know, just doesn't eat any animal protein whatsoever. We'll do a little bit of dairy, but you know, her challenge, when I looked at her diet overall, and she swims 4 hours a day,
yeah,
she only had about 30 to 40 grams of protein in her diet.
Oh, like, wow, no.
That is a big, big no-no. And primarily came from quinoa and Greek yogurt.
Oof.
So in her case,
not, you know, very bioavailable, yeah.
Right. So we looked at, okay, where can we get some more protein? Because with the collegiate athlete, the biggest challenge is time. And, you know, these are girls that they swim from 6 to 8, then they have to go straight to class, a lot of them. So there's so limited window for recovery. Mm-hmm. Between the time they get out of the pool, there's about a 15-minute chance. And if they don't bring food with them, they don't have time to eat. So it's like, well, can you bring nuts? Can you bring fruit, peanut butter? Can you bring it, you know, a sandwich? What about bring a scoop of non-GMO soy protein or veggie protein? So there's a lot of options to where, you know, we can get the right source of protein for her. And that was her challenge.
Well, you know, with that population, there is the risk of something called FAT, which I'm sure you're familiar with. It's an acronym that's actually the opposite of the way it sounds. It's not fat. It's actually very, very skinny, emaciated, and you lose your periods. It stands for female athletic triad, which is too much output exertionally and not enough input dietarily. And these gals lose their periods. Sometimes they lose the ability to have periods permanently. They become osteoporotic, and it's a really serious problem.
Yeah, and you see that a lot. I say a lot, but you see that more in the athletes in the cross-country area. That's typically where I've seen some of these athletes, you know, occasionally in other, you know, but female athletes are primarily, you know, just reducing calories, some of them in the fear of gaining weight, some of them in the fear of thinking if they're lighter, they'll perform better. And if someone has some of those issues, I try to look at teaching them, hey, look at food as your ally. Don't look at food as your enemy. And I use the analogy for a car. A car can't run on an empty gas tank. And if you put the right type of fuel in your body, just like you put the right type of fuel in your car, it runs well. You don't have to bring it to the mechanic. So it's looking at and teaching, you know, teaching these young individuals, you know, don't use food as your enemy. Food is only, you know, if you don't eat and don't train your body properly, the engine's not going to run. And hopefully they understand that. But
And you don't want to use the the bargain basement regular. You want to use the highest octane fuel that you can to get the best performance.
And the one area I don't specialize in is eating disorder. So if I suspect, if our team of sports medicine professionals, the athletic trainer and myself and the doc, if we suspect there's an eating disorder, we're going to find the right professional for that individual and athlete to go to, because a lot of times it's more psychological. They need help. They need someone to work with them on some issues mm-hmm. they may be having outside of the athletic arena.
Well, it happens in boys as well. I mean, what we see in girls often is anorexia, but in boys we see the opposite, which is like bigorexia. They just want to get big, and they're cramming themselves with supplements and protein powder and working out excessively, as you say, which is counterproductive because they have a poor body image. But it's the opposite. It's not. They can't get big enough, whereas some gals can't get skinny enough. It's not necessarily.
I just read a great book on that. It's called Eating Disorders in Athletes, and it's how to intervene, prevent, and treat. It's by a colleague of mine called Allison Mankowski. She did a great job of really just making it simplistic, the causes, the reasons, you know, and really how to treat it. So it's really cool that they have resources out there now.
It's pretty prevalent. What about the timing? You know, timing is thought to be very important, and there are various schools of thought. Some people say, well, you know, before you work out, you know, make sure you have, you know, a hearty breakfast so that you're fueled for the workout. Other people say, look, don't burden yourself with food. You know, work out. I personally like to work out on an empty stomach. I'll have maybe, you know, black coffee or decaf, not necessarily. I don't have caffeinated coffee, and or, you know, some water, maybe just a little bit of juice. And then I go work out, sometimes for long periods of time. And then, you know, I build up a huge appetite. When I come back, then usually within a half an hour, I make sure I have something to eat to replenish the glycogen and also the protein. Is there one better way, or is it different strokes for different folks?
It is. It's completely different for, you know, for anybody, depending on what they do and what time they work out. If someone's going to get up and go, you know, just train for 30 or 40 minutes, they probably don't need anything. And if it's early in the morning, they can get by. If it's an extremely intense workout session, then maybe they need a little bit of a combination of carbohydrate and protein before their workout. Mm-hmm. Really more carbohydrate.
Yeah, I might do that after a particularly long bike ride. If I'm going to go like, 50 miles or something, I will eat a little bit before that.
Sure. And again, I look at it the individual. If I have an athlete that tells me, I just can't stomach any food before, you know, I lift at 7 o'clock, then I'll say, okay, that's fine. Maybe 30 minutes into your workout, let's sip on a combination of carbs and protein to get something in your stomach, especially if it's an athlete trying to pack on weight and trying to pack on muscle, because the last thing I would want him or her to do is get up on an empty stomach. They haven't eaten in maybe 8 to 10 hours, so they're already in a negative energy balance. Then go burn 600 to 800 calories for an hour of training, and then really start their day in a really negative balance, and then they have to play catch-up by eating a big breakfast, snacks all throughout the day, lunch, dinner. So it all depends on that individual. But, you know, we look at every scenario. If someone can tolerate food before, then we do it.
Or it depends on their sport, because I think different sports have different demands, correct?
If it's golf, maybe you don't need to eat big meal right before. If you're going to swim for 2 hours, then, yeah, we really need to get something in the stomach either 30 minutes before, or we need to start replacing fluids, you know, throughout the swim practice.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Well, so let's focus on supplements. And, one of the ways that I heard about you is that I believe you're a brand representative for Nordic Naturals, which is the supplement that makes high-quality omega-3 products and fish oils.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so you are into omega-3 products and believe that they have some efficacy for athletes.
I do. Yeah, I think, you know, I look at that from a couple of different areas. Number one, from the inflammation side. I work with a lot of Major League Baseball players, and particularly the pitchers. You know, a guy that's a high pitch count guy, he might throw 80, 90, over 100 pitches in an inning. You know, post performance, you know, that's in his protocol. We want to make sure, because there's some good data that shows fish oil is a natural, good, high-quality anti-inflammatory that works. It can be just as effective as NSAIDs.
Right. And for some of these guys who come from, small-town America, the closest they get to eating fish is maybe Mrs. Paul's fish sticks. They don't really eat a lot of fish.
Right. No, absolutely. So if the diet, and our diet is typically so high in omega-6, which causes it's really pro-inflammatory, we need the balance. So I usually have guys, you know, anywhere between 2 and 3 grams of a good triglyceride-based fish oil like Nordic Naturals to where we can use that in their protocol. And in addition to the anti-inflammatory piece, I mean, there's a lot of data with heart health. So looking at, you know, just the benefits from maybe possibly improving, heart health from a cholesterol standpoint. But also they're starting to show a little bit of science maybe there's some benefit from body fat, maybe reducing body fat.
Insulin resistance, that thing. Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for the athletic side, though, it's more from the inflammation. That's where I see fish oil being extremely beneficial.
Okay. Is there a basic set of supplements which are advisable? Can you give general recommendations, or is everything custom for each athlete and their circumstances?
Well, I think that the three or four that I think are pretty standard in any protocol that I have is, number one, a good multivitamin. And when I say good multivitamin, you know, I'm really looking at a multivitamin that, you know, is made with the right minerals for optimal absorption, because there are a lot of multivitamins that are on the shelves that are just really they use really low quality raw materials, and especially from the mineral side. So a lot of your basic malters like Centrum and
paltry amounts of things.
They use like magnesium oxide, and they use really inexpensive raw materials that have no absorption. So I typically like to get a good food-based multivitamin that has, they use what's called the Albion minerals for higher absorption.
Various chelates.
The amino acid chelates, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Vitamin D, we talked about that. If someone's levels are really low in vitamin D, that we look at that, and typically that's going to be a part of their protocol. A good probiotic. Most of us, our gut health is not where it should be, and we're not getting enough good healthy foods in our body, you know, particularly from some of those cultures and enzymes that could really help, as well as the fish oil. So those are really the three or four standards. But I look at, again, everybody individual. What can they afford? You know, if someone has just a very limited income, you know, we do a multi and we'll do a vitamin D. That's pretty standard.
Okay. So and, let's I'm sorry, go ahead.
No,
because what I was going to do is let's do a little, if you don't mind, let's do a little lightning round here. I'm going to mention a supplement. And you can give me your feedback on its efficacy. So, ready, set,
yes, sir.
Go. Okay. Creatine, big popular supplement. Lots of kids taking it because it makes you big. It makes you strong. What's your take on creatine?
I really like creatine, and actually, it's extremely safe. The big misconception on creatine is that it causes all these liver and kidney and muscle problems, but creatine's got over 48,000 studies if you do a PubMed search, and probably 2,000 of those have been in exercise performance, and out of those 2,000, 70% have been shown to be beneficial. So I really like creatine.
It's well-researched, well-documented, unlike some other things.
Probably the most well-researched dietary supplement when it comes to sports performance. And the problem is most companies don't use a good German creatine. So AlzChem, based out of Germany, they're a raw material supplier for a branded name called CreaPure. A lot of companies now are starting to use CreaPure, but a lot of other companies are using a generic form of creatine. It could come from China. It might come from another country that, you know, it's inexpensive. So if you can find CreaPure just by itself, my young athletes, I say 5 grams before and after a workout. You know, for some of my bigger athletes, you know, I really do the loading phase. So there is a benefit there. And be honest, they're looking at creatine now in more clinical populations for brain health and muscle wasting conditions.
Right. So it's interesting. I mean, it's if they call you a muscle head, maybe there's something to it, because creatine helps both your muscles and it does have brain benefits. So especially, you know, for, you know, aging athletes and non-athletes even, there may be additional benefits. It's interesting.
Absolutely.
Okay. Carnitine, L-carnitine.
Yeah. Typically promoted a lot as a fat loss agent. There's really not much research to say take L-carnitine for fat loss, because you're not going to see any results if you do. Where there could be a benefit is what's called L-carnitine L-tartrate. And that I actually have one of my pro baseball guys on, because he's got elevated creatine kinase levels, and that shows markers of muscle damage.
Damage, yes.
So there's been some good science. 3 studies have been published to show if you take 2 grams of L-carnitine L-tartrate post-workout, we can see a reduction in creatine kinase levels.
Perhaps so faster recoveries.
Absolutely.
Great.
And, you know, typically after a workout, if you do anything heavy, particularly from the resistance side, you're going to have elevated creatine kinase levels anyway. And then possibly, you know, looking at what's called a glycine L-propionyl L-carnitine, that has been shown to increase nitric oxide production. There may be some
GPLC.
Yes, sir.
Abbreviated GPLC sometimes. Yes, sometimes we use that product.
So there may be some benefit from that, you know, from that component as well. But overall, from the fat loss side, you know, there's a lot of companies are using carnitine or acetyl L-carnitine in their products, mm-hmm. and there's not much science to really show there's a benefit there.
Okay. Coenzyme Q10.
Yeah, I think, you know, great, powerful antioxidant, especially if you take it in ubiquinol form. You know, I think for those taking statins, there's a, you know, we've seen a benefit mm-hmm. there. Actually, out of New Orleans, I think Dr. Richard Dykman did some work in that area to look at, you know, not muscle wasting, but just really muscle pain for those that are on a statin. From the endurance side, maybe there's a benefit. I mean, I don't typically...
Maybe for older individuals who don't have the capacity to make it as readily?
Correct, yeah. Correct. And, you know, I typically don't recommend it as part of the protocol for a lot of my athletes because they're on so much stuff already, and I say so much stuff that, you know, a lot of these things they have to buy, fish oil, vitamin D, maybe a probiotic, a multivitamin, and CoQ10 is quite expensive. So it just depends on, you know, the individual. And if they're already on it, then I'll probably, you know, see if they're taking the right form of it. And if they're not, then I say, here's a brand that might, you know, contain the right form.
Here's one that's of interest to me, especially because I really think there's some science behind it. Beet juice.
Yeah.
And now more readily available versions of beet juice extract.
It's so funny you mentioned that because I emailed our swim coach this morning and said, hey, here's something you want to try. There was a study that was just published, and I don't remember the journal, that showed an improvement in aerobic performance, VO2 max, in swimmers using beet juice. And I have several colleagues are using this with their D1 sports.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, I have a colleague of mine at a big D1 university using it with his football team, you know, as a pregame booster. A lot of athletes are starting to really see there's a benefit in taking beetroot extract. A lot more science is now coming out.
And the principle is the nitric oxide principle. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's just been showing to really increase nitrate and nitric oxide production, which, you know, if we can vasodilate those vessels and get more blood flow to the working muscle, you know, we're going to possibly see an improvement and an enhancement in performance. That is my specific knowledge of it. There's mm-hmm. probably other professionals that can speak a lot more clearly about it than I can. But I know Dr. John Ivey has done some work out of UT Austin looking at this product or looking at that supplement. But, you know, we can get it from food. If you want to take some beets and put it in your smoothie, that's one way. Or you can buy the extracted powder and put it in 4 to 8 ounces of water and drink it about 30 minutes before you, you know, do any type of activity.
Yeah, no, I think that's very promising. D-ribose, it's a type of sugar that seems to be part of the energetic pathway.
Yeah, I haven't read about this in a long time. You don't see much about it in a lot of, at least in the athletic performance side. I've tried it in a few. The studies on sprint performance that were probably done 10 years ago did not show any benefit when it came to giving sprinters D-ribose. I've seen there's some benefit for maybe heart patients, but I personally don't know enough yeah. about science behind
it. I would agree. I've tried it, and I didn't think it really enhanced my cycling performance. But I think for weak or sick individuals with damaged mitochondria and heart failure, that's where it might be helpful. Quercetin. There are actually some studies published on quercetin. The quercetin might have an impact on endurance performance.
Yeah, there's a product called FRS to drink. And
right.
That's the primary ingredient they use. And, you know, there's some science to show that it could have some boost in endurance performance. And, again, something that's another one I don't read a lot about. I stick more to the strength, power, and recovery side. But, mm-hmm. you know, I have colleagues that, you know, do look at that. And one colleague specifically really likes and uses that a lot with her endurance athletes. So, yeah, there has seemed to be some benefit when it comes to quercetin, when it comes to the endurance side.
And on a less esoteric level, something that's real popular and I think you know, pretty wholesome is the whey protein.
Yes. Yeah.
And why whey protein? Why not, you know, any old rice protein or soy protein? Is there some specific advantage to whey protein?
Well, it's just the digestibility. So when you know, each protein has a different score when it comes to digestibility and absorption. Whey protein has a score of 100 for biological value. Mm-hmm. So that means everything we consume gets digested. And there's a lot of solid data that, you know, says whey protein post-workout, you know, increases that anabolic, increases basically what's called muscle protein synthesis, or the recovery of muscle tissue after exercise. What the science is really showing now is a combined form of protein is just as effective as whey. So if you combine things like egg, micellar casein protein, which is slow acting, with a whey, you really get a good anabolic response post-exercise. And all you need is about 20 grams. You don't need 40 and 50 and 60 grams like a lot of some of these athletes are consuming. 20 grams, anywhere to up to 30, has been shown to really be the key number to facilitate protein synthesis post-workout and help your muscles recover. Because what's inside of that is 6 grams of essential amino acids, particularly leucine, which seems to be the key amino acid to really create that anabolic response.
Right. Leucine is said to head off sarcopenia in elderly individuals. It's one of the amino acids that make up muscle protein. And so that leads us to branched-chain amino acids. They're sometimes sold separately as a way of enhancing strength and bulking up. Is there any basis for believing that that's the case?
Yeah, and it all goes back to leucine. So, you know, not that isoleucine and valine are not important, but what we've noticed with a lot of the science over the last probably 3 to 5 years is leucine seems to be that key branch chain, and a lot of companies now are selling leucine individually. They're selling it now in what's called the free acid form known as HMB, which HMB is a metabolite of leucine.
Hydroxymethylbutyrate.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so that seems to be the key to increase or upregulate what's called mTOR, which that is the key component and chemical pathway to stimulate muscle protein synthesis and that anabolic response after an intense training session.
Wow. ATP is sometimes sold as a performance enhancer. Any science behind that?
And again, it's coincidence you asked about that, because there is I had a company send me a sample of their new product that has what's called the branded ingredient Peak ATP.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to be the branded version now, and really one of the only forms I've seen. And it's got a couple of studies to show.
Because it's hard to get ATP into the cell. It's made in the body, so the question is whether taking it orally, it's actually going to find its way to where it needs to do its job, which is within the cells.
And what I'd love to see now is taking that ATP product and combine it with creatine and see, hey, what really happens if you combine the two? Could you create even more of a powerful response to deliver more ATP and phosphocreatine to the system? So, yeah, there's not a lot of science on the ATP, but the science that is out there for power and performance has been pretty positive. But I think there's only about 2 or 3 studies so far.
And what about good old-fashioned caffeine? Because a lot of athletes just swear by it. And in fact, I have to say that I don't drink coffee, which is actually an advantage. If I'm faced with a real daunting race and I really need to get a little extra, power, I may take a little jolt of caffeine, either in a goo, one of those gel things that you carry around with you in your kit, or maybe in a cup of coffee. Is there science behind that, or is there potential for caffeine to overstimulate you and then you exhaust more easily?
Yeah, and really a lot of people, I think, are using caffeine for the neuroprotective, not really neuroprotective, but neuro side, just getting that alertness, getting that boost, that mental focus, that mental acuity that you're looking for. There's science from both sides, from maybe the endurance side and also really from the sprinting side. So some athletes see that they need...
And it's legal, by the way. It's a performance-enhancing supplement, which they can't bust you for taking.
Well, I think at the Olympic level, I think WADA, it has to be extremely high. They may have taken it off. I haven't really looked at their regulations in a while. I know at one point, I think at caffeine at certain levels.
Okay.
I know at the NCAA level, you'd have to drink a pretty good bit of coffee to get to that level. I mean, you'd have to probably take caffeine powder, which you never want to do.
Right. That could kill you. And it has.
And I'm like you. I'm a decaf person primarily because if I have too much caffeine, it's going to cause some arrhythmia, so I try to stay away from
it. Well, it just jangles my nerves, and then I'm overstimulated.
Yeah, and you look at also things like Red Bull and energy drinks.
Yeah.
But people are using it. The athletes I see use it, they're not using it from a performance advantage, to swim faster or run faster or lift more weights. They're using it because they're tired.
Yeah.
They're not getting enough sleep. And
there's no substitute for sleep and proper
rest
and recovery. And a lot of these folks, as you said earlier, they shortchange themselves on a very important aspect of training, which is recovery, where you consolidate the gains you've made and your muscles repair.
Right. You know, I have some athletes that they'll train 3-4 hours a day. Then they have to study all night, and they're going to bed at 4 and 3, and they're getting up at 6 and 8, and it's like they're just eventually it catches up to where they just have, you know, and they're trying to live on caffeine, and it's going to catch up to them.
Yeah, actually, sometimes I see these young student athletes in my practice, and some of them come down with mono-like illness. They crash and burn. They, you know, have problems. Are there any other major supplements that I didn't mention?
Yeah, just, you know, what in my power athletes, what I like to combine is I like to combine creatine and beta-alanine. I think those two...
Beta-alanine, okay. So explain what that is. Beta-alanine, it's an amino acid, and it has something to do with... Isn't it a glucogenic amino acid that can get converted into sugar through a certain pathway in the body?
What actually beta-alanine does is it increases muscle carnosine levels.
Okay.
What that does is acts as a buffer, so it kind of blocks the production of hydrogen to where you can get a couple of extra reps.
So you have less lactic acid accumulation?
Exactly.
Wow.
So, you know, and usually in my pre-workouts or any type of workout supplement, I like to have something like that, maybe a beetroot from the nitric oxide delivery, some beta-alanine, a little bit of creatine. So we have kind of some, you know, leucine, or HMB, so we have kind of a powerful force, but it's so hard to really put all that into one jar and sell it. Not that I don't sell supplements, but, you know, companies are doing, there's some companies out there doing a really good job of trying to get to that formula, but, you know, when I used to work for a company and help them formulate products,
mm-hmm.
it's just, and then once I figured out the cost of the raw material, like, okay, now I see, because it would cost them $30 to make it, and then they'd have to sell it for $80.
Right. It's like some patients say to me, they say, can't you just put all those supplements into one pill? And I say, well, number one, it would be the size of a baseball. And number two, it would cost you, you know, $300 a bottle. So you would, you would be put off by the price point. Whereas people, you know, they'd be very happy to combine 10 different things that cost $29.95. That works for them. So there are considerations in terms of that. Well, okay, so this has been a very, very illuminating discussion. And clearly, you know your stuff. So our call to action on today's Intelligent Medicine is, A, check your website. Remind us where that is.
You can go to www.mysportsdconnect.com.
Great. And are there any other resources that you'd point people towards in terms of making supplement and diet decisions if they're serious or even casual athletes?
Yeah, I think for the athletes, if they're looking for supplement safety, you know, how to know if your products are clean and tested, you can go to nsfsport.com, or you can go to informed-choice.org.com. Those are two organizations that do a good job of testing the products. We typically lean to NSF because, you know, they're aligned really well with Major League Baseball, the NFL, you know, now the National Hockey League. That they're really the go-to source that a lot of companies are recommending, or a lot of organizations are recommending, you know, use them as a source, because a lot of companies who use them, they're a third-party testing agency. They come in, they take your finished product, they test it, they make sure anything that's in there is clean, and then once they put their certification and stamp of approval, you're good to go. And we also have a supplement safety, I think it's a free course that you can take on our website. So if you go to mysportsdconnect.com, and I think it's how to know if your supplements are safe, you can click on the link there, and it'll be available under our courses.
And that would be good not just for athletes, but also for coaches and trainers and people involved in advising athletes from the standpoint of nutrition health professionals. So great. Thank you very much for a very comprehensive overview of a big subject. Tavis Piattoli, and we hope to get you back on soon to share more wisdom with us about the world of sports nutrition. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks for joining us. This is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.